I'm Dustin Zahn, and this is Trainwrecks. Be sure to check out other episodes on all your favorite streaming platforms. Follow the podcast on Instagram at trainwrecks.69. Like and subscribe, leave reviews, share it with a friend, blast it for your neighbors. I don't give a fuck. Do what you gotta do. Also, be sure to check out the episode links for detailed notes on the episode. Aaron updates the notes every week with mentions of nearly every artist, label, and club in the show. Thank you, Aaron. So, today's guest is Jesse Anthony, better known to most of you as Marone. He's a techno DJ from the Netherlands who is also a co-founder and resident of the Erster community parties, which take place primarily in Amsterdam. And I hope I'm saying that name right. Anyway, a few years ago, his stripped-down percussive take on techno propelled him into the international circuit after the world opened back up. He's a regular at all the clubs and festivals that people are dying to play at. And the crazy thing about Jesse is that this isn't his first brush with success. Yeah, it turns out he was a professional basketball player who ended up becoming an Olympian. Despite knowing him for a while, I have no idea how this trajectory played out, so I'm just going to find out right with you. So screw it, I'm excited, let's just get into it. All right, Jesse, here we go. Inappropriate questions only today. Your agent's not going to be happy with me. Now, it's good to have you around. Thanks for doing this.
Thank you for having me, Dustin.
Yeah.
Super honored to be here.
And also, he just really came straight from the airport to the microphone, which I've done that before, and it's kind of stressful, slightly pain in the ass. So I appreciate you making that happen.
Yeah, we're here. This is the only opportunity that we had, I think, in the rest of this year. So
yeah, we've been trying for a while, too.
Exactly.
He's doing the last Ground and Theory party tonight at RSO. Which by the time you hear this will be over, but I just wanted to say rest in peace to Grounded Theory. Nice party series.
It's really sad, man. For me, I think it's a really sad moment because also, Henning and my agent, Michael, they've been doing this for 15 years. And also, before I even signed with Triangle Agency, this was actually the first party for me in Berlin.
Oh, shit. Okay.
So, you know, this party holds more of a emotional connection to me as well. I remember it was in the garden from Elsa, and that was quite a party. It was pretty cool.
Yeah, I mean, it's always been a good series, and yeah, I mean, like the thing is, there's always so many crazy parties going on in Berlin with stacked lineups that it's really hard to compete on any level. You know, like you can have an incredible party there tonight. There's probably three or four parties going on with great lineups. So.
Right.
Anybody that wants to try and do a party series in Berlin, hats off to them, because there's a lot of competition out there.
Yeah, and that's the thing. Like the word competition, when it comes to events, I even hate it, you know, because there should be enough for everyone. And as soon as you got your community, then you should always get that support from this community. And some people just hop on from club to club or stick to one that feels good. But, you know, the part that we as promoters should feel that is a competition or feel that it is a competition is just not the most healthy thing, I would say, for a scene. But another side is the reality. But I hope everybody has a great time tonight.
Yeah, let's see what happens. In the meantime, I want to catch up with you quickly. We'll fly through the early shit and then just get on to the fun stuff. Am I correct that you were born and raised in the Netherlands then?
Yeah.
Okay.
Born and raised. Amsterdam.
Amsterdam. Okay. And you're still there today, right?
Yep.
You're not leaving there anytime soon, huh?
I think I'm not. You know, and actually traveling so much, and I've traveled with basketball before as well, but also traveling so much with DJing, I came to appreciate so many different places, so many different cultures, but also got to appreciate Amsterdam a lot more even, especially when it's not even that big of a city. It does offer a lot. It offers a lot when it comes to our scene. It offers a lot when it comes to freedom. And also what I really like about the city is that it's very child safe, I would say. You know, so the conditions of living is really good. And I've got to see that by traveling more. So, you know, I would like to have my kid grow up in Amsterdam and have in that environment. Same as my girlfriend. So
yeah, I totally get it. I think... You, for most people, they have to kind of leave home for a little bit to realize what's going on at home, whether it really is that good or that bad, or you know what I mean?
Maybe for everybody.
Yeah, all right, for
even,
sure.
Yeah, even if you if you're living in the best situation, the best city that you think that is, but as soon as you start traveling, you see a whole lot of different things. Might be better, might be worse, but you do get to appreciate home more.
Absolutely. I mean, man, by the time I left America in 2010 or 11, I was so fucking done with it. But, you know, going around the world, seeing it all, doing the fucking coolest stuff and then the worst stuff, really, I appreciate the States a lot more now. I mean, it's still like kind of a terrible country, but it's also so awesome. Like, but you don't know that until you go and find out what else is out there.
Definitely, you know? Definitely. And nature, man. I really forgot about how beautiful America can be.
It's out of control.
The last tour I've had, I took the car and I drove from LA to Las Vegas. Vegas was shit, but yeah, the drive to Vegas was one of the most beautiful things I've experienced.
Yeah, and you next know? Time, it's a good drive. That's good that you did it, but try and go north, like go up to San Francisco through Big Sur.
Been there too.
God damn,
been there too. Yeah, I was there too, and I took the Golden Gate Bridge and actually saw the other side when we came to the Pacific Ocean side, and I was like, man, this is beautiful.
It's
really
insane.
Beautiful. The cliffs, the open view about the ocean, it was really, really, really beautiful.
Yeah, I personally, that's kind of what still keeps me going. Like, I'm actually going to San Diego next week,
nice.
And I'm just really looking forward to getting back and seeing a lot of it. Yeah. It's kind of funny because parts of California are a flyover state. No person should ever have to see it. And then other parts are easily some of the most magnificent places I've ever seen on the planet. It's incredible.
Same with South Africa. I just came back from South Africa.
Oh,
same
it's thing. The shit. I love it out there. I can't wait to go back.
Yeah, man. But like, just like what you said just now was spot on. Some people that live there should not live the way they're living.
Mm-hmm.
And then some people have the best life ever. You know, it beats Cali. It beats any place in the world when you live in camp, like, you know, what's it called?
Cape Town?
Clifton or like, there's another place close, like in Cape Town, which is really, really nice. But yeah, you know, the difference between rich and poor there is just so big.
It's out of control.
It's out of control, you know, but I've spoke to a lot of locals. I've been to the township as well to see what they say and what their perspective is. And actually got a different view now in the country that at the beginning was a bit skeptical because of the segregation. But now I really believe in the country is going to get better also. And in the next 5 to 7 years, what they believe is there's supposed to be a big change, you know, with the new government. Yeah.
Okay. I wasn't aware of that, but I don't know. I was totally, like you said, skeptical, and also just, really, all we were ever taught about in America is the segregation part of it, you know? So you're like, I could take it or leave it. But then I got there and I'm like, the people that I met were amazing. Everything was cool. The food was great. Like, I just
amazing food.
Away. Yeah.
Amazing food. I was surprised. Man, the food is good.
I love it. I still like, and I didn't really get to go too far out into wherever, but I want to try some like not city food. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Next time. So you grew up in Amsterdam. I guess, you know, it's no secret that like professional basketball was a big part of your life prior to music, right?
Right.
Did you kind of just get thrown into that right away?
Music, you mean, or?
No, like, was it like you get into high school and you're like, okay, life is ball now, and that was
high
it.
School, we're talking when I was 10 years old.
Okay.
Yeah, the moment when I told my dad that I wanted to be a professional basketball player was when I was 11 years old. And, I started when I was 10. I first touched the basketball when I was 10. So that was my dream. That's my only focus. You know, I was going to school, but my focus was becoming a professional basketball player. So me and I'm lucky that my family supported me that way and got me to the point where I could actually be a professional basketball player. But I loved that part of my life that I had.
Mm-hmm.
And I've learned a lot from the moments to work hard and, you know, to stay focused on what you want to achieve. And,
I mean, I think that last sentence is a big part of it. Cause it's like, I was actually speaking to Ogazon the other day and she was also very driven and motivated.
That's my girl.
And,
yeah, I love her.
She's great.
She's amazing.
but you know, she's like, really takes that seriously and doesn't look at it like, oh, we'll just, you know, roll the dice and see what happens. Like, no, I'm committed. This is what I want to do. And you kind of need that drive and also the, what's the word I'm looking for? Like the dedication and everything to really make it happen.
True. But what I love about her, when it comes to that, everything comes natural.
Yeah.
You know, and it comes organic. She's just her energy. And with her energy, she just works hard, stay focused, but she's not trying to shortcut her way to success. And I really can appreciate it. I could sense that from the moment I met her.
Yeah, yeah. I totally did too. Like, it's very evident. Yeah. But I think it's safe to say that because you were so dedicated with basketball and like knowing what it takes to get to that level, or even just getting up every morning and going to the gym and shit like that, you know, when it came time for the music career or whatever, you're like, you got to get up and do it. You know, like a lot of people, like me personally, when I was younger, I kind of got into it for fun and I didn't really think it would be a career ever. I was kind of stoned, like, oh yeah, maybe I'll make a record this week. Who knows? Yeah. And these days you really got to get up and be like 9 a.m. like, okay, let's get to it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I had met you, I guess, online through the techno stuff. And then I actually found out about your past because of a Red Wings shoe thing, I think.
Oh, really?
Where you were modeling for that. I'm like, yo, is this you? And you're like, oh, yeah, I was this and also an Olympian and blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, what the fuck? Like, I don't know. There's more to you here than just some guy that's playing techno, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, that's, I think it all just kind of came together, you know?
Yeah.
Especially 2021 was my craziest and weirdest year, actually.
I bet.
Because that was the year where, you know, we were just coming out of COVID. My daughter was born, playing professional basketball, going to the Olympics. Mm-hmm. Then, you know, the touring part was getting busier. I was still modeling. After Black Lives Matter, I actually got more modeling jobs than ever, you know? Damn. So you kind of feeling tokenized, but at the same time, you enjoy work as well,
just,
you know?
Get it. Somebody's going to get it if you don't.
Yeah, yeah, and it was just a lot, you know? And that was the year where I felt like, okay, now we need to make a decision, you know, what we're going to do. What is the main focus? And then, you know, I gave up modeling real quickly, actually. And then I was actually working towards the end of my basketball career, which was really hard for me to do because this is my comfort zone. This is what I grew up. It's like, you know, waking up, drinking your coffee or your tea and having breakfast is something that you do every day since I was 10, you know? Mm-hmm. So it was really hard for me to let go. And honestly, you know, me and my coach, we had to make the decision together because I was just not, I knew it was over, 2003, January. I knew it was over.
2003, you knew?
No, sorry, 2023.
Okay.
But I couldn't make that decision to say like, yo, I'm hanging it up right now. I couldn't do it.
Yeah, of course, man. Like, I couldn't listen, do it. I've been doing this now for 26 years, DJing, records, all that stuff. And with the pandemic, I kind of was convinced that it was over. But of course, deep inside, you're like, do I want this to be over? And part of me does, and part of me is like, no, of course not. Because like, if it's so much like your identity, it's you, what comes after that? Right. Is there a path to success afterwards? Can you find happiness from something else? Like, those are
big questions.
Fuck yeah, man.
Big questions. And that's why I'm so glad and happy and very grateful that I found a new passion after basketball. Yeah. You know, because that's just hard to do. And to me, that is real richness, you know, not the money, not the you know, the fun part of it all. It's just that I was able to find something that I really love doing. And I'm so passionate about, the same way or even more than I was with basketball when I was 12 years old, 13 years old.
Yeah.
You know, so to have that same eagerness, the same will to fight for something, to reach something. It's just the journey part is the most beautiful thing for me.
Absolutely, for sure. I'm going to move this microphone just a little closer to you.
Yeah.
Cool. So for those who don't know, you were in professional sports in the Netherlands. You went on to become an Olympian, which I want to bring up a little bit more later. So what did that involve for those who wouldn't understand at the time?
What do you mean?
Like, you know, for example, I'm from America. I know how the NBA works, or whatever. I'm not really familiar with what's happening in the Netherlands. Like, how often, what's the season like? How many games, stuff like that?
Oh, the season is around 9 months.
Okay.
But then besides the season, you always, not everyone, but in my case, I had most of the time I had national team.
Okay.
So national team works also 2 months. You would have about 2 weeks off in a whole year.
Okay.
That's it.
Wow.
So yeah. So the whole year is actually based on basketball. Social, you know, the social part of your career is quite small. I'm a very social guy, so you know, I really care about being with my friends. So I had to pick moments and make, you know, create moments where I would share time with my friends, but you know, there was not a lot of time of going out or, you know, partying and all that stuff. So that all came a bit more after my career while I'm working in mm-hmm. the industry to be more in clubs and stuff. But yeah, so it was a really almost since I was 15, it was like a 2 times a day practice thing.
Wow. So it was totally dominated in your life.
Yeah, but yeah. I loved it.
Yeah, of course.
You know, so it never felt like an obligation. It always felt as, you know, getting better every day was my passion.
Totally.
In what I do. So the last years, I must say, sometimes it did feel like, oh, got to go to practice again, you know, because at a certain point in your career, you're not really getting better when it comes to skills. You're getting better by reading the game and mm-hmm. becoming better by, you know, the smart things that you do as a, becoming smarter as a basketball player. You're not really becoming better when it comes to skills wise. So
it's the same thing with DJing, man. You know, yeah, like I'm at this point now, I can put 2 records together, but it's like, okay, now let's talk about on a philosophical level. Like why should I play this track after this one? Or how can I get the people excited? What makes me stand out? You know?
Right.
So I'm sure that you had to look at that also from that perspective with sports. You know?
Definitely. And even already with DJing.
Yeah, for sure.
You know,
was the NBA realistically ever in your sights?
It was my big dream.
Yeah,
definitely. But I came to realize that 6'3", being a guard, really fast, not so heavy, was just not good enough. It was just not enough. You know,
okay.
So genetically wise, I'm not made for the NBA unless I could jump 50 inches in the air and start dunking on everyone like Ja Morant. But I'm not. You know, I'm a shooter. I'm very quick and fast, but I was never heavy and strong enough in my legs to make it to the NBA. But my goal eventually changed to how can I be the best version of myself? And actually that is still now today. You know,
awesome.
Yeah. So I don't set goals for 10 years. I don't set goals for where I want to be at a certain point. I just try to enjoy the journey and try to be the best version of myself as I can be when it comes to being a person and when it comes to being, you know, musically wise. So it's just about evolving, just about organically growing.
Awesome. And so let's see, I'm trying to think, if you started off around 10, would that be like late or early aughts, like 2000-ish era, something like that?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. So I guess you missed like the era with the Bulls and Jordan and all that. You're more like LeBron James era.
But I was still able to catch up on it and you know, and get inspired by it. Because Kobe Bryant Shaq was my first favorite player.
Yeah.
But I was always biased by, you know, being for the Lakers because my dad, he was a big Laker fan. He used to box in the States. He used to box in LA actually. So he was always a big LA guy. You know, so for me, it started off with Shaq coming to the Lakers from the Magic, and then the 17, 18-year-old fro kid, Kobe Bryant, came to the Lakers as well. And he became my favorite player, and he resembled so much to Michael Jordan. So, you know, that was my interest to just getting a few years back of watching Michael Jordan. So, yeah.
I guess the reason I bring it up is because, like, my biggest point in life where I was in the NBA was definitely watching the Bulls coming up and like everything around the Jordan's Last Dance documentary and stuff like that. I watched it and I had so much fun with it. Like, yeah, it's biased and blah, blah, blah. There's things to say about it, but just as a time capsule, it was so cool and it brought back so many memories. You know,
I can imagine, especially because that was set up so well, you know, go back for it in time.
Totally.
I can imagine.
You know, and I think about it cause it's like, so at that point, Jordan was the fucking man, right? But what the documentary explains, and I don't think people still fully grasp on, is like how, like especially the Pistons stuff, like how fucking hard they made Jordan work. Like even though Jordan was number one, these other guys were no slouch. Like Jordan had to do everything he could to beat him. So it's like the competition is so high that number 2, 3, 4, who maybe you don't ever hear about in sentences anymore, are still like damn near just as good because they're such amazing players. You know what I mean?
For sure, for sure. And then, you know, especially with the the whole comparison thing about LeBron James and Michael Jordan nowadays, for me, it's hard to let go that MJ is the GOAT, you know?
Yeah.
But if I look back at the tapes now from the Jordan time, even with the Bad Boy Pistons, they were rough and they were physical. You know?
Oh, yeah,
man. It was tough. It was really tough guys, you know? But when it comes to talent, the stuff that LeBron has to catch up with in the 22 seasons that he's doing right now against the talent that he's seen right now, Jordan never had that.
Man.
And it's hard for me to even say this, especially on a mic, but Jordan never had that.
Oh, absolutely. It's undeniable.
and especially, you know, I was one of those guys that was just kind of hating on LeBron because, you know, I didn't want him to be close to Kobe and Michael because those were my guys, you know?
For sure.
But the last 7 years, man, the way LeBron is just keep on going and keeping his body healthy, 22 seasons, that's insane. He's 40 and he's going to year 22 and doing windmill dunks and in between dunks and still being relevant, and the numbers are even better than his rookie season. He's still up there.
It's pretty crazy, right?
It's
I mean, like to do 22 years of anything, period, any industry across the board is wild, but to be at peak physical condition and still rocking it is wild.
Yeah, very inspiring.
Yeah. And also, one thing that I thought about, and it was like when they were showing all the footage of like Dennis Rodman and shit, and he was just like bad boy, crazy, 90s style.
Man.
And like, that's really kind of what all the ravers are like now, right? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's wild that it's just picking up on it.
And I think he's so cool. You know, because to be able to do what he did and to be, you know, to be able to be how he was, marrying himself, you know, and you know, having Carmen Electra and doing her on the, you know, on the Bulls practice facility, all that stuff.
Yeah.
Michael Jordan had to go get him from Vegas.
Yeah, all that shit.
Stuff.
It's crazy.
That's wild, man. He didn't care.
My dad actually he was sitting at a blackjack table in Vegas and Rodman came up and sat down on the table and they played cards together, which
was
crazy. Yeah, and like my dad has no reason to fucking lie about this shit. Like
yeah.
There's way other things that he could probably get off more on. You know what I mean? So
yeah.
I'm like, that's wild that happened, you know?
That's so funny.
Yeah. So we could go on for a long time about basketball, but so when did dance music come into it? Because it sounds like you had no time for anything.
Yeah, so, you know, when I first really got in contact with electronic music was actually through Afro House, to Black Coffee, Kula the Song, Black Motion. You know, this South African music that really got to me. My dad, he used to be a bouncer for a club in Amsterdam Hotel Arena, and they had a party called Salsa Lounge. And they had three rooms. So there was one salsa room, there was one hip-hop R&B room, and there was one room that was more Afro House. And that's where I actually got to hear that music for the first time and really experience that. And I was way too young, actually. I was 16. But, you know, my pops was in front of the door, and he was just, yo, you want to come by for a little bit? And it was always daytime, you know? So
yeah. It
was never nighttime, and I had to be in bed still on time. So, but that's the first time where I really got introduced to this type of music. And then that was, what was this? It was 2006 or something,
mm-hmm.
2007, you know, and was actually not until 2013, 2011, 2012, I would say, where I actually got more into house and techno. And I experienced techno for the first time. So in that period of time, I actually got to realize, because I had a certain vision of what techno would be. A lot of sounds, not a lot of groove, not a lot of rhythm.
Mm-hmm.
But I was so wrong. I was so wrong. You know, so.
Yeah. You were half right, you could say, right? Because
There's
plenty on the other side.
Mm.
So what was the first thing that you experienced then that really?
I'm going to tell you right now. It was DVS1, 10 hours in Trau.
Okay, that'll do it.
That would do it. It's an understatement. I mean, that was a great introduction to what techno can sound like, especially rhythms, you know,
mm-hmm.
parts in that set and parts of sets that I've heard throughout those years. I could really hear a certain rhythm, a certain groove and a certain continuation in the music that really got to me.
Mm-hmm.
But it would never be in a certain consistent sound. You know, it would be more flows of different type of sounds and still great sets. But I was so attracted to that certain part of those sets, you know. And when I was going online and going on SoundCloud to look for music and to listen to that music, I could find moments in sets, but I could never find consistently. Yeah. So, you know, when I got more attracted to this music, and that's the thing with me, if I'm attracted to something, I can really focus on it 100%.
Mm-hmm.
And when I actually found some tracks that I really liked, then, you know, I was listening to those tracks separately, or I would just skip through sets online and just keep going back and listen to the particular set, a part of the set, you know. But at a certain point, I was like, you know, I got about 30, 40 tracks now. Actually, those tracks are so nice. I want to hear them back to back to back to back to back. So, yeah, in order to do that, I need to be able to, you know,
to play them.
So, yeah. I actually just for fun started, you know, touching the decks and actually just figuring out how it goes. Nobody taught me. It was just self-taught. Flicking around and just doing stuff.
Do you have a friend with decks, or did you buy some? Or?
No, it's just me and one of my best friends that he tried it a week earlier, and he was just doing it for 5 days in a row, and he kind of figured out how to do things. And we just hopped in the studio together, and, you know, I just went with him and I had the tracks that I had. And, you know, after practicing for a while, I was like, you know what? I'm going to try those 30 tracks that I have and actually record them. So I recorded my first set. Awful.
Of course.
Completely awful. You know, but I still liked the tracks, but yeah. I wasn't hearing the dynamic I was searching for. Did I know how to get there? Hell no.
Yeah.
But I was tweaking that first set that I've, you know, all those 30, 40 numbers. Yeah. I probably played that set 60, 70 times, recorded that 60, 70 times.
Yeah.
And at a certain point, I felt like, yeah, I'm actually getting there. I'm actually getting the dynamic of this, you know, of these tracks. So that's when I actually, that's how I actually started playing and actually appreciating techno the way I loved it, you know?
Awesome.
So it's funny because usually people start playing, learning how to play, and then find their sound. But yeah. I knew beforehand what I wanted to hear, but I couldn't play.
Yeah.
So for me, it was the other way around, you know?
Yeah, it is kind of interesting.
Yeah.
But also, you brought up one thing that I think is really worth doubling back on. You talked about how you had the same 30, 40 records or whatever, and you're like, I want to, you just learn those inside and out and figured out like what makes, you know, how to make it work for you.
Yeah.
And honestly, that's how it was back in the day. Like when I started out, I didn't have a shitload of money to spend on records. So like if you had 100 records, like that was kind of a lot of records for us friends, you know, and then of course you buy more, but you can't always afford to buy more. So you just start learning, like try out the B2 on the record, see what this is, what that is. And maybe you're not even crazy about that track, but you kind of heard it enough times that now you like it. And you really get to know these records inside and out, so you can play them with fucking no problem, you know, and then you're just wrecking shop. Whereas these days, I think when people start off, the whole world is their oyster, man. You got Bandcamp, Beatport, whatever the sync thing is, like all that shit where you have so much music and influence coming at you.
Right.
So how do you find your sound? That's pretty tough, you know?
Right. And then it comes to the social media part where people are seeing people having success. And then the whole intention shifts from loving music to I want to be that. Mm-hmm. And I want to be successful. You know, and there's so many people that ask me on DM randomly, like, how did you become successful? I'm like, what kind of question is this? You know, and I think the whole focus on being successful is what kills people, man. It drives them crazy. The comparison between artists, it drives them crazy. And I'm trying to stay away from that as far as I can, you know, and really focus on loving what I do and become the best me and the best version of me, because nobody else is going to do that for me.
Man.
And looking at others is never going to make me better either. You know, you can be inspired by others and by your idols and learn from sets and being on the dance floor. But comparing yourself to others, I'm staying away from that, far away from that.
I've tried. It doesn't work. You know, there's an old quote, everybody else is taken, so you might as well be you.
Man, that's powerful.
Right? You know, so that's the way I look at it. And, you know, I think these days, yeah, because of...
Hold on, I got to write that down. Man.
Yeah, go for it.
Yeah, I got to write that down.
But, you know, the thing is, everybody wants to be big and popular, like you said, and I don't think they really care what the musical message is or the medium.
Yeah.
You know, which is a bummer. But the ironic part is that, like, your social media is kind of popping, but it's because you're busy being you and not so much like, how do I, you know, make this shit pop. I mean, I'm sure there's a little bit to it, but, you know.
Yeah, like, the thing is with social media, especially, you know, I've grown a lot on social media the last couple of years. But before I made my social media and my SoundCloud, actually, I knew beforehand my passion doesn't lay with producing yet. I'm always saying yet now because you never say never, you know. But my main goal was to follow my passion, and that was DJing, interacting with people. So I knew beforehand, because in the time when I was starting, it was still that narrative. You have to be a producer also, you know, to become relevant as a DJ. And as a producer, you kind of need to DJ to, you know, make money.
Yeah.
But I didn't want to do that. I just wanted to do my thing. But I also didn't have that urge to become this DJ because I was playing basketball. I was just doing this for fun.
Mm-hmm.
But when I started my social media, I knew right away that I'm going to use this platform to, you know, to express myself musically, and that's it. You know, to say what I have to say, and that's it. And then when the people follow me, to connect with them personally in that way, and that's it. Not because this video worked so well, oh, it went viral, I got to post all these videos. No, the only thing I have to do is post reels because that works. No. You know, I'm doing what I feel that is, you know, right at that moment, the right time to do, you know?
Yeah.
And I think that for me keeps it healthy, keeps it me, because all the managers that try to hook me, you know, for and try to make a plan for how to become bigger on social media, how to become, you know, how to make this life of being an artist become bigger. I'm like, I'm sorry, man, I'm not your guy, you know, because first of all, I'm not a producer. Second of all, my agent got everything covered that I need to be covered. And my social media, I will never get that out of hand because that is me personally. It's not fake, you know? So if somebody else is going to do that for me, then who am I?
Exactly. You know, and like, the other part is you don't need that because people already can see the natural aspect of it. It's like, it's organic, it's real, it's whatever, you know? Like even my social media, whatever you call it, kind of sucks, but like they know that whatever I'm doing on there is real because it's my personality coming out of it. And then you see these others which are just really carefully doctored. You not really get anything of it other than some like good looking pictures or something, or like some dates coming up. And honestly, if that's what you're doing, fine, whatever. But I think you're doing a lot of work for no reason, almost.
Yeah. And you know, I know it's everybody do their own thing.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not trying to say that when other people do it, it's a bad thing or anything. But for me personally, the way I'm judging, you know, I find this platform, it could be important for, you know, connecting with your people right away.
Sure.
And they can be updated for what you're doing, you know. But when it shifts away from that importance of music and who you are to likes, followers, and being famous, you're lost.
Totally. You know, and like what you were saying earlier is like people asking for advice, like, what do you do? And I have had that question come up too. And I'm like, well, you know, it's kind of like there's multiple paths to the same destination. What works for you ain't working for me, and vice versa. You know what I mean? But one thing that is kind of universally true is like you got to have momentum, you know?
Yeah.
And it sounds like your momentum, would you say, picked up around 2021? Would that be right? Is that when it started popping?
When I started realizing that I actually had a future in this was in 2019, right before COVID.
Okay.
That was actually, you know, simultaneously with Eric's community, simultaneously with my party. You know, it was kind of, that's why I always say, like, Eric's community needs its residents. And the other way around as well, you know, because the sound, we're so based on sound that without our resident DJs and without every person that we have in our crew, it wouldn't be where it was right now. And the other way around as well. And that's why I always hold up, like, you know, if Ears of Community is growing a certain way, then everybody has to grow that certain way as well. Because, you know, we need to live up to a standard of ourselves. You know, we can't just lean on being, oh, we're an Ears of Community resident, or, you know, you can't lean on anything. You just got to keep working, keep focused, and, you know, and don't hang on cloud nine too much. Just, you know, stay grounded. So
for sure. And what do you think it is that like helped you to stand out and really grab people's attention?
Ooh, I don't know. Actually, I don't know. I think, you know, maybe it's because of what I do musically. I connected with my culture.
Mm-hmm. just kind of keeping it real and doing what you do? Or
yeah, I mean, keeping it real, that's my opinion, you know?
Yeah.
So that's, you know, for me, what is real for me and what I feel and how I, you know, go about this music is because it's coming from my heart, it's coming from my soul. Other people might think otherwise, but yeah, what they think is irrelevant for me, you know, because I know what I love to do and I'm doing what I love to do. So for me, I think why is catching? I think maybe the cultural part about it and that I have a story around it, musically wise, that I connected with my heritage and with my culture. I think, I mean, that's what my whole name, my artist name is about. And that's what all these sets that I've put online in the early days is also about. You know, so it's a bit of a history lesson, it's a bit of music. And with every set that I've recorded, I always had this in my mind. I always had this certain word or title in my mind, how I wanted to perceive this in a musical experience, you know?
Absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, even just with the artwork on some of these mixes too, it's like very obvious what you're going for, this sort of tribal African environment and whatnot. And
yeah.
You know, a lot of people in this, especially in techno, they love to take the tribal element, and I don't want to say that like they abuse it, but they kind of just do the bare minimum with it. You know what I mean? Yeah. Whereas like, you know, no, this is my heritage. I kind of want to really dig into this. And it's pretty evident with your sets that like.
And the thing is that the why I got so attracted to this certain part, a certain sound of techno, is because it really related to my heritage. You know, mm-hmm. Surinamese and Maroon music can be very fast and rhythmic, a lot of percussions, you know? Mm-hmm. So this is where it's all coming from. It's not just, oh, I like this type of music, let me just go play it. No, it's actually because I felt it being on the dance floor. I can feel that. I could feel, man, this is really sounding like, you know, it relates so much to African music. It relates so much to the rhythms.
Yeah.
That's how I got deeper to it. That's how I wanted to know more about it, you know? So it's not just from, let me make a cool concept and play this music that I love to play. No, I actually felt that it was so connected. And especially for a lot of brothers and sisters, a lot of black people that just don't really know this, you know? Yeah. And the more, over the years that I've been playing, I see more and more color on the dance floors.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah, yeah. And it's really nice to see. And it's really, really good to see to have the diversity, but it's also nice to see them exploring and seeing them, you know, finding out that it is actually much more closer to them than I thought it would be, especially in America. You know how, you know, people can be in America,
yeah.
Especially my black brothers and sisters over there in America, they don't know about techno so much.
It's crazy, man.
Yeah. So, you know, the majority of the scene there is mostly white, and people don't really realize this, that, you know, it's a much more diverse type of music than you think, you know?
Yeah, well, I mean, dude, I didn't know for the longest fucking time that black dudes invented techno, because, like, this was kind of, not pre-internet, but not everybody had, you know, like, fucking dial-up modems and stuff. The information was available, but it was hard to find, and it was slow to find, you know what I mean? So, like, I thought Jeff Mills was white for the first 3 years, you know, and then I went to these parties, and of course it was like there was other races there, but as you said, it was mostly white, especially Wisconsin and Minnesota and stuff like that. Yeah, I mean, it's kind of a bummer because, you know, there's the whole thing with Detroit techno. It was really at the advent of hip hop blowing up too, and that kind of took over some of the success.
Like, yeah.
I really wonder how insane techno would have been, and especially how black influence it still would be if hip hop didn't take some of that, you know, spotlight away.
I mean, techno is becoming bigger, let's be honest.
It is, yeah.
It has, you know, has a lot of bad ways to go about it, you know, becoming so commercial, becoming more of like an EDM stage sometimes. That's what, you know, what a lot of people say and what they think. But it also has a lot of good things about it. And for instance, what I just mentioned, you know, that people are exploring more and it's easier for them to find this type of music. And within techno, there's so many sub-genres, of course, so you can find your way. Mm-hmm. But what I see, and especially in the underground scenes, there's more color. There's more color, there's more diversity, and, you know, people really unite on the dance floor to be one, and that's the most beautiful thing for me to see. You know, I just came back from my all-nighter in Johannesburg, South Africa.
Was it Toy Toy or?
No, Toy Toy is always on a Friday. Okay. But this was, they call the club Toy Toy as well, but it's that club. It's called Ant Club. And I did my all nighter there on Saturday, packed. And to see that crowd.
It's fucking awesome, huh?
Man. And, you know, I was so happy because, you know, a country with so much history. And not so long ago, there was still an apartheid. And you see people on the dance floor smiling with each other. You know, white, black, Asian, Indian, doesn't matter who you are, where you're coming from, they were one country on that dance floor. And that's more powerful than their politics.
Absolutely.
You know what I mean? You know? So we're having I'm actually get to play 9 hours for these people that are feeling so powerful together and feeling as one. For me, that was beautiful, you know? And it made me think of the track Black Coffee once made, We Are One.
Mm-hmm.
And I would really how do you say this? Tell everyone to listen to that track, you know, because the lyrics that are actually being put in that tracks as well are really about, you know, we are one as human beings, and especially in the time that we're living in with all the wars and stuff, man, it's really powerful to see that, you know, and to see how that even that track had effect on the people there. Because Afro House there is like playing soccer here.
Oh yeah, totally.
You know, so it's really a way for them to get out of the townships and the hoods.
Yeah. So I write for other like bands and singers and shit like that outside of techno. And I was tapped to work on an album that was supposed to have a lot of like South African sort of, Afro House influence and stuff like that. So I was like trying to dig up a lot of this and just kind of get familiar. And a lot of the production techniques are really cool. The videos are fucking wild. A lot of it was kind of corny, I have to say, but like super fascinating, the energy that comes from it and whatever. I was like, okay, this is a very interesting world.
Yeah, that's funny.
Yeah. I think, you know, it's unfair to really go much further with your story without mentioning, is it Erster Kamuni? Is that how you pronounce it? Okay. I've always wanted
solid, man. Solid.
I try. You know, I do my due diligence. Yeah. For people that are tuning in from all over, can you explain what it is for those that are unaware?
Okay, so Erster Kamuni originated in 2017. And we were just a group of friends, and we were just actually, you know, we fell in love with a certain style of techno. Not really a certain style of techno. We fell in love with techno, but we were missing something in Amsterdam. You know, we felt that everything was really based on having a big name, and, you know, big names attracts big crowds, and everything was really focused on that. And even the big good clubs like Trouw and the School back in the day, there were clubs that, you know, still had the big names, and they would have some local DJs, but it would also be really focused on house, disco. And even though the 24-hour parties would be from techno to house, disco, super cool. But we wanted something that was more consistent, you know. And I had, you know, one of my good friends, Gils Weerwind, he came to Berlin already a lot, and he went to Berghain a lot and saw many other parties here in Berlin. And he got inspired by this party called Staub.
Oh, yeah, great party.
Yeah.
It's still around,
yeah. I saw it, actually. And and he was telling me, like, man, we have to do something like that in Amsterdam where, you know, we would actually have a consistent sound of techno, which is dance floor minded, and that's, you know, a day party on a Sunday.
Yeah.
Because that's not really around. And then we're just not announcing lineups, you know, and see where it goes. Because, you know, we wanted to focus on having good music instead of having big names.
Yeah.
Well, I can tell you that the first year, a year and a half, horrible.
I bet.
Flopped. You know, we had 30 people at our first party, 50 people at our second party, and mostly our friends. And we were so confident that this could work, you know, because it's something different. But we got slapped on our faces right away, and we realized that, like, yo, Amsterdam's not ready for this type of stuff like it is in Berlin.
Were you playing Bang and Techno already at that point, or was it still a bit more in time with whatever was happening in 2017?
It was same type of techno, but just a bit slower.
Okay.
But it was the same type of techno, yeah, definitely. But that, you know, it's not that specific. You know,
yeah.
It can go from Claudio, you know, Claudio Piercy, Luigi Tocci. Like, it could be
some
from
deep shit,
some deep stuff as well. But yeah. It was just more of that, you know, that timeless sound that we were searching for. But at a certain point, you know, we realized like, hey, man, this might not be it. But we didn't want to do something else. We didn't want to do something to become popular, or, you know, we were just some random guys to do, you know, to throw a party.
Mm-hmm.
So we stuck with what we believed in. And then we actually started doing illegal raves. And the first one was 30 people for like the first 10 hours. Cops didn't come. At a certain point, it was during Pride in Amsterdam. At a certain point, it was like 100 people coming. So we had about 130, 150 people. And those 130, 150 people, those people, I think, really spread the word, because it was a really cool, tiny, illegal rave. And it was also people from Berlin were actually there, that, you know, we saw that they posted stuff online like, hey, this really reminded me of the early days. And that's when we had the feeling like, okay, you know, we got to push through. We got to do something that we, you know, we got to keep doing this. So we did one a year, like half a year, between a half a year and a year later. And that one had 300 people. So we knew it was spreading word, you know. Mm-hmm. And then the third one we did illegally, that's when we had to move from spot, you know, from Amsterdam West back to Amsterdam North. Then we got rolled by the cops every time. So then we went back to Amsterdam West under a motorway. And there we stayed for 17 hours.
Wow.
So we had a legal raid for 17 hours, I think about 400 people. And we knew right away this was it, you know. But we couldn't control like the no photo, no video policy or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, we should be thankful for that one, because it was one person who made a video. And it was like almost like a hill of sand behind us,
mm-hmm,
that you could see on the video while people were dancing in front under a motorway. And people were like, where is this? Is this Amsterdam? Because I see a mountain.
Oh, wow.
So everybody thought, it was like, where's this place? And the video, those 7-8 seconds of the video, was actually really, really cool. And that went viral on Instagram.
Okay.
So we didn't know what was happening. Okay, like, you know, what are we going to do? And we knew also, if we're going to throw another illegal rave party, it's going to end up wrong. Because now you're going to have people that are coming for a hype, you know?
Yeah.
While these people that were there, they were carrying sound, they were carrying stuff, they were helping us out, they were actually building.
It was actually a community.
It was a community already, while we didn't know anyone. But it was, everybody was a part of this little thing that we created on that day. So we had a real good talk together. We said like, okay, listen, if we're going to do something now, it has to be in a club. But it should feel like it's still that same freedom as an illegal party. So we found Garage Nord, square box, good Function 1 sound system. Everything. It feels like a garage. It feels like really kind of like semi-illegal, you know?
Yeah.
And we knew we had to do door policy, you know, based on, you know, because a lot of people that were there on our illegal rave parties only go to illegal raves.
Mm-hmm.
So we wanted to create something where those people that were usually only going to illegal raves still feel the same energy when we go legal.
Yeah.
So that's what we did. That's why we have our door policy. You know, nowadays with Ears Community, a lot of people have their opinion about us, and especially from the outside world, they have an opinion about us. And I you know, I can't blame them.
No.
You know, especially when something is becoming popular, they will have their certain opinion about stuff. You know,
there's always criticism with success.
Yeah, you know, but it's sad, because we worked so hard to create something that is for the people, you know, and that people want to look good, that people want to look cool. That shouldn't be the you know, the focus on why this party isn't good or you know, or a bad thing. Because our door policy never came from you got to look cool.
Yeah.
It always came from, we want to protect what we had from the beginning, add more people that really have this understanding about our concept and love what we do, and create a beautiful party. That's the main thing, you know?
Yeah. It's tough. I mean, like, you can throw the best party and always find somebody that'll complain about something. But, you know, and I do it the same with our parties. We get criticism about something. Sometimes it's super valid, and sometimes I'm like, I wish you would have just come talk to me first before blabbing on the internet about this shit.
Internet gangsters, that's what I call them.
Pretty much, you know, and I mean, I think everybody, especially if you get denied, that really changes your opinion on a party. Nobody wants to get denied, but sometimes they need to be, you know, like.
Yeah.
Going to parties without a door policy, there's not too many people that are excited to go to those parties. Like, there's clubs in Berlin here where anybody gets in and, like, it's the shit show, man. You know, yeah. Everybody's talking shit or grabbing your girlfriend's ass or something like that.
But the most important thing for me in that part is I want people to understand why there is a door policy. Not to be cool. Not to be, you have to look a certain way. No, it's to protect something. Protect something that still everyone is welcome from, but not welcome in a way where you don't know anything about our concept. We want people to actually do some research about, you know, what are we doing? Why do we not announce the lineup? So that means when we don't announce the lineup, that means you're not coming for Renee Weiss. Yeah. You're coming for good music. So this good music can come from Renee Weiss or a 17, 18-year-old kid that nobody knows.
Yeah.
You know, and we want people to focus on that more instead of, you know, lineups or who might be there or being cool or whatever. You know, and I wish people would understand it. If, you know, you can't make everybody happy, you know. But for me, the work and the effort that we put in this concept over the years is very important for me to understand that, you know, we're in here to do something right, you know, to do something that is community giving instead of taking.
Yeah. I mean, I totally get it, especially when you're not putting the lineup on the door. Like, it's pretty hard for people to come and say that it's you're trying to take something from a community, you know? Yeah. Like, it's that you're effectively eliminating a potentially huge revenue stream, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, I have that also, like this festival I have, The Great Beyond. We don't advertise outside of, well, this podcast and our own social media channels. But other than that, like, we haven't paid for any advertisement. And I'm like, that's kind of a dumb idea if you own a festival. But we also, like you said, you're like, we're comfortable with the idea that it's going to take a while to build up. And then right. You realize, like, okay, this is mostly people that get it and they give a shit,
right?
Versus whoever's coming through the door at a random party, you know?
Yeah, man, definitely. And I highly believe in it. You know, I highly believe in stuff like that. And I think for the long run and the durability of it, it's really important to stick Absolutely. What you believe in.
Is there any like DJs, producers, residents, crew members that deserve a little shout out while we're at it here?
All the residents, man, that I have.
Yeah.
You know, Flitz, Amoral, Hitam, Renee Weiss, Floss, Amoral. Who did I left out? Winfour. These are all the residents that we have. I got to be careful, man.
I get it. I forget shit. And then you get messages. And
I think I'll name them all right now. Ines. Wow, I can't forget about him.
Of course not.
No, I would have to think through it. And, you know, all the residents of the Eerste community. But also, you know, I'm very proud of the whole Amsterdam community, what we're doing right now. And what we've created over the past years is unity instead of competition. You know, promoters discussing with each other, like, which dates we're going to do. If it's going to be the same date, then so be. And if not, if we can, if we can make sure that it's not on the same date, then we try to work that out. And I'm super proud about this type of energy, you know, because we need this. You know, techno was never about being a competition. It was always about unity. And even when it becomes bigger, I think it's very important to still keep that energy. Doesn't matter how big we become, because it's enough place for us all. You know, we have our own community when it comes to Eerste community, but for instance, Fall Sessions has also their own community. It does overlap in a bit, but we do love each other. We do show love to each other. We do show love to other smaller parties as well. You know, and I love it when DJs like Rodhead, when he comes to Amsterdam, he has to play a show and the next day he would do a free illegal rave somewhere, you know, because that's giving back to the community. And he sees that something is out there, you know, and I really appreciate it when especially legends like yourself come to these type of parties and feel that energy and feel like, hey, this reminds me of the older days, because that's what we want to keep pushing. We want to do something that, you know, that we felt is the good and the right standard for techno music.
Totally. It should be fun and exciting. And also for people that are doing well, not to forget to have fun and forget where they came from, you know?
Exactly.
And I mean, like you brought up Rodhead, and I also know, like I spoke to some other promoters in other countries that, you know, honestly, last minute thing, like he said, off the tail of another gig coming basically for peanuts. And he's like, because he knows like that's kind of what's popping. And I think it's a good thing to try and incubate those kind of scenes. Cause a lot of these people, they're like, they get the money. They're like, cool, I'm going to sleep in till 5 PM at my 5-star hotel and then check out and go to the next gig. And that's that, which I mean, I get it. Like if you get a little older, it's hard to get excited, but the real motherfuckers, they keep it going, you know?
I can't blame them, and I won't blame them, you know? But for me, to have one of our first legal parties and to have DVS1 in there for 300 people, you know, he was one of the gods, you know? Mm-hmm. And to have him at Air Community, we explained our concept, and to actually say like, yeah, I'm up for this. That meant so much to us, you know?
Yeah.
And especially when you look up to someone that also, you know, put some light to my career where I feel like, you know, how big I'm going to get doesn't matter. If those illegal raids are still in Amsterdam or is a small party coming up, which do not have the budget to pay me, I will still go because it's doing something for the community. That's what he did. So who am I to not do the same thing?
Yeah, you know, I think you got to pay it forward to some degree, right?
Yeah.
You know, like... I mean, the way I see it is like, it doesn't matter where I go for what promoter. I just want what's fair. Like, you got a big party going on, big budget. I want some money. Yeah. If it's like, you're not really making much and the routing works, like, all right, whatever. What do you got in your pocket? You know what I mean? Like, I think you got to stay down to earth like that. Otherwise, you lose a bit of that something in your soul for this stuff, you know?
Yeah. But I mean, you can't look into everyone's situation. You know,
everybody's different.
Yeah, we also have artists, you know, that eventually cancel because, you know, at certain points they feel like, yeah, man, sorry, man, it's not enough money. Yeah. But we cannot do more. In the 5-6 years that we did that we done Ears Community, we never took money out of the pocket.
Yeah,
never.
I get it. I believe it.
You know what I mean? So for us, we can't even do more. You know, and that's why we always try to explain. So, you know, in the right way, what we're doing, what we stand for, because we walk in against a big risk every time we throw this party. We can't, even though it's popular or whatever, every time we throw this party, we're stressed about how many people are coming because we don't know. We don't have no pre-sale tickets.
I get it, man. I mean, we're at a point now where it's like there's always an amount of life crippling debt that we have to deal with and just hope for the best. And it's been okay so far, but you're like, shit, this could go south real quickly.
Yeah, it's scary.
But it's fun. It's exciting. And like you said, once the people are there and they're all on the dance floor, it's worth it. You're like, okay, fuck it. I'll keep going. Even if it was a nightmare to produce the show or whatever, you know,
right.
Like, okay, 100%. Yeah. Still worth it. Fuck, I'm still stuck doing this. It's in it, you know?
Yep.
So
it's in the blood now.
what's the future looking like for it? Just continue doing dope parties wherever? Or?
Yeah, I mean, as a community, we'll keep doing what we're doing. Expanding, but not expanding too much. You know, we want to keep it to the core, keep Amsterdam super small. But we do try to go to other cities as well, you know, because also we want to show people that, you know, you can also throw parties without announcing a lineup.
Yeah. You're doing them here in Berlin, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I think Berlin is almost more popular than Amsterdam. We do get more people here than Amsterdam.
Yeah.
But I think it's just also a bigger crowd that really loves this type of music. But yeah, you know, it's not easy, but we love doing this and we'll keep on going.
Right on. I kind of want to jump because I know you got a heart out and I want to get through some things here before we leave.
Yeah.
I want to talk about the Olympics.
Oh, yeah.
I don't really get to hang out with an Olympian all the time. So for those who don't know, you were in the Summer Olympics of Tokyo 2020, which technically became 2021, right?
Correct, yeah.
In case people forgot, it was kind of a messy situation. On top of being like one of the most expensive Olympics to ever produce, it was delayed a year.
Yeah.
And there was no audience, right?
No audience.
And it just... Japan was extremely concerned about foreigners ushering in another outbreak and everything. So I just can't imagine what that was like. Tell me everything.
Yeah, it was really, really tough, to be honest. You know, in COVID, all we could do preparing for the Olympics was train in Amsterdam. Sometimes we would have still tournaments, but then you would, like for instance, you would go to Abu Dhabi, go from the airport directly to the hotel, 5-day quarantine in your room. 5-day quarantine in your room. We couldn't do stuff, just be in room, get food all day, be with a teammate also. And then you would, in those 5 days, you could only go to practice and you can go to your room. So we didn't, we couldn't do anything else. You know?
What would you do, like sit-ups and push-ups in the room or like?
No, we could work, we would work out, and then at a certain point, you know, the quarantine, we would have training, and then we have video, you know, for our opponents or whatever, and then you have to go back to your room. So there was a lot of time that you just had to sit in your room. And the tournaments that we had to play, we had to test every time, 3 times a day, those type of stuff, man. Like it was crazy. And this was on the way to the Olympics.
Man.
So can you imagine that all these sports persons, all these athletes that are going to the Olympics, because we had to go into quarantine a week before in Japan, do testing every day, and during the Olympics, we also had to do testing every day. So can you imagine when you work in 3 years, 3.5 years to work to the Olympics, and you get affected on day 3 in the Olympics, by Olympics?
That didn't happen to you, did it?
What? That happened every day.
Oh, I thought you meant like you got like
not
you
to
got
me.
COVID.
Yeah. Not to me. No, it was not to me, but a lot of athletes during the Olympics were still getting COVID. You know, and this, we would sit in a big main hall where you would have food, bro. You would not touch anyone.
Wow. You would, it kind of sounds like you were in basketball jail for a while.
You were. I mean, not basketball jail, but just athlete jail. And I mean, the village was still cool and it was really fun. And you get to see a lot of athletes, but you couldn't just easily go to other sports to check them out. No.
Oh, well, that was what I was going to ask about, but I'll get to that point.
No.
But I mean, like, I just can't imagine the like anxiety and uncertainty. It must have been unbearable because you train so hard for this unique, like once in a lifetime thing, and you don't even know if you're going to get a chance to compete. Right?
Yeah. So it was very stressful. Very stressful.
Damn. And well, I was going to ask if there was any other sports you were particularly interested in checking out, but you couldn't really go and find out.
Man, if I could, I would go crazy because I love tennis. I love boxing.
Okay.
You know, so I would probably check out the 505 basketball players, of course. But I just love sports, you know. So, but it was a bummer to not see it, but I was there for one goal and it was to get a medal. We failed, you know, in the last second, in the to go for a medal was against Belgium. We lost in the last second.
Brutal.
But, brutal, definitely. But it was the first Olympics that, you know, that I was one of the 4 first basketball players out of Holland that ever stepped foot on the Olympics. So I was really proud of that. I felt that, you know, we had a chance for a medal, and I'm so proud that the guys actually got it done this year in Paris because teammates got the gold medal actually. So from no medal.
That's awesome.
They got the gold medal this year.
Nice.
That is funny because people ask me like, oh man, you didn't want to be there? And then, you know, you would think that I would say like, yeah, I want to be there. You know, I want to be for that moment. But I was just so happy for them and so proud because this was bigger than basketball.
Yeah.
This was, you know, actually kids in Netherlands, they will dare to dream for the Olympics now. You know, and of course you want to be there. But my passion lays with music. Yeah. Right? I'm doing a whole different thing.
Plus you get what their feeling is and you can like kind of live vicariously. Like, I know what that must feel like. So I'm just happy you got that.
Yeah. The emotions.
Wild. And so I don't know why I envision this like sort of comedy movie type scenario where like the guys are kind of in the rival sports, like giving each other shit or something.
Yeah.
Who are the coolest dudes from the other sports? Did anybody stick out? You're like, oh, the fucking boxer.
I mean, I saw a lot of NBA players, of course. I saw Luka Doncic, which was
he can ball, man.
He's so good. Yeah. And I've been following him since he was 13. So to actually see him when he was like, I think he was 21 at that point.
Did you get to hang or no?
No, I mean, I met him for a bit. We talked for a little bit and we took a picture. And but if I stand behind him, he was 21 or something. I think both of my legs could fit in one leg of his.
Wow.
He was huge. I'm talking about 6'8" for the Europeans, about 2 meters 1, 2 meters 2, baby face, but then a killer. You know, he would go at everyone. Very heavy, very strong. But it was really cool to see him. But also, you would see Novak Djokovic walking around, you know, like other, like so many athletes. And I think that feeling of being around so many, actually the best athletes or people, athletes that worked 3.5 years or 4 years to get to this point, was very inspiring.
Yeah.
It was really cool because you're not the only one who's working hard for a spot, you know? There's so many people that actually just not made it.
Yeah.
And to be able to be around people that all made it was very inspiring, and I was very grateful for that opportunity.
I heard it really gives a certain vibe then in the village, because it's like, I don't know that it's necessarily a vibe of superiority, but like you kind of all understand what you had to go through to get to that point. Like, yeah. I don't know if that creates a certain camaraderie or excitement or whatever.
I think in a way. And also that the biggest stars, they have the same tag as you have. You're an Olympian.
Yeah.
You're not more than that, bro. You just got to win your medal, but you have the same tag. And I think that's special that everybody's equal at that point.
Nice. So I listened to an interview with a female Olympian, I forget who, and she said that all the girls wanted to bone the swimmers. Like Michael Phelps is dumb, but they're like, yo, he can get it. Oh, yeah. I don't know. Do you think that there's some truth to that?
I think so. What I've heard, it goes crazy there. From what I've heard, you know. But the thing is with this COVID stuff, I think it was really different. Nobody's trying to risk anything.
Oh, yeah. You get tested every day.
You get tested. It's not like you test all the time, and then when you come to the Olympics, you're like, oh, now we're free for all. No, you still test every day.
That's true.
And on day 6, you can get out of the Olympics.
Yeah.
So everybody was very careful in that way.
Man. Well, I'm really glad that you got to be an Olympian in Tokyo. It was a great place, but that's a rough year to be an Olympian, man.
Yeah, and you know, I can imagine for Olympians actually, because I played in the stadium, 14,000 seats, no seats, and I still felt the energy. Can you imagine with the 14,000 people in a half court of a basketball court?
That should have been wild.
Wow.
Fuck.
Yeah.
So, I mean, like the Olympic business model, it's kind of strained right now. It's like proven that hosting the Olympics doesn't really lead to the major turning point for the host or city country that it used to guarantee. Some of the population, there's like a growing population that, you know, they're complaining about the growth of economic inequality and stuff like that. I can understand if you have comments that you want to keep to yourself on the matter or whatever, but do you think the Olympics will continue to remain as they are, or do you think it's going to take a little bit of a hit?
I think this is more of a business view report, you know. I think for an athlete, this is the biggest stage, you know. This is where you want to get through it for an athlete. The athletes don't really think about the business part of it, or you know, what it does for a country. They just want to get this medal.
Yeah.
Gold, and if it's not gold, it's silver. If it's not silver, it's bronze. That's the only thing people are focused on, you know. Maybe a bit selfish, but that's what athletes have to do.
No, fuck that. I mean, that's what you show up for, right?
Yeah,
exactly. You're not like, oh, what matters is that we had a good time. No, you're there to win the Olympics.
Exactly. And I you know, me personally, I never really invest too much time in how it's all set up and what is fair or not when it comes to the Olympics like that.
Mm-hmm.
So I couldn't really give you an honest answer also when it comes to this.
Yeah. I mean, I think that what it comes down to is it's just anything that when you have so many different wheels turning and money going to different things, there's going to be some complaints or corruption along the way or whatever. And it's just kind of like, well, I don't really know that it's I don't think it's avoidable. It's like just running a city. There's going to be something that pops up, you know?
Right.
Would you say like you're a bigger fan of the winter or the summer Olympics then?
Summer Olympics.
Summer for sure. Okay. Yeah, I didn't know if like maybe there was a, you know.
No, reason. For sure. Yeah.
Anyway, sorry for all the Olympic questions. I don't get the opportunity so often. I actually sat next to this female hockey player on the way to Montreal for a gig once. I was playing at Stereo, and we were talking.
Field hockey or ice hockey?
Well, ice hockey. Oh, and and I was like, oh, you were just in Russia? And I was like, who did you play for? Because like she had a little bit of an accent, not much, but she's like, oh, I played for America. And I was like, oh, shit, because they just got their asses fucking wrecked like a week or two earlier, you know?
Okay.
And I forgot to ask who this person was, but it was kind of a fascinating talk. And like 6 months later, the Sports Illustrated Bodies issue comes out, which are always just crazy to begin with, like if you ever look at those. And I'm flipping through with my now ex, and I noticed that girl in there. And, you know, incredible body and all this. I was like, yo, check it out. This is that athlete I was talking about. Yeah. And she's like, damn, and you didn't try to bring her to the club? And I'm like, wait, no. But you would have been down with that? She's like, no, you fucking asshole. You know? So I'm like, oh, okay.
She tested you. Yo.
But yeah. So after you lost the Olympics then, and well, you came back, you said you already had this point. It's like you were doing modeling. Techno was kind of taking off, everything like that. Would you say like doing the Olympics coming back, was that like a nice bookend of being like, I think I'm... the writing's on the wall, I'm out, it's time to shift focus?
You could say that, but it was more that my priority shifted to my number one, and that's my daughter.
Oh, well, that'll do it.
You know, so my daughter was born 2 weeks before, 2.5 weeks before the Olympics.
Ooh.
Exactly.
You mean the actual in 2021 or when it was supposed to be in 2020?
No, actually in 2021. So my girlfriend, and this is our first kid, you know, we only have one kid, but yeah, this is our first kid. And she had to, you know, do it by herself with the help of my parents, with the help of her parents, of course, for after 2 weeks of being together as a family. So that was...
That's insane.
That's tough. That's tough. And I highly, highly appreciate her for, you know, she didn't give me a headache just even once. You know, she was holding it up together at home. And I'm very grateful for her, because without her, I couldn't be doing what I'm doing right now. And that was then, but that's also now, you know. So we have a good way of balancing everything out together. And I, you know, I make sure that I take care of them.
Mm-hmm.
She's really a part of the success that I'm having now, because without her, I couldn't do what I'm doing right now. And, you know, to be able to focus on the Olympics, to be able to focus on basketball for the majority of the time that I was there meant a lot. Because also for me, it was really tough to leave my firstborn child after 2 weeks and go 2.5 weeks and be with the teammates, you know?
Insane. I mean, I get that you did what you had to do, and it was not even really much of a question. But, yeah, that's got to be brutal.
But it also, something grew in me. Something grew in me that also what I'm doing right now is for my kid, not just for me.
Yeah.
The fire that comes within you as a father, you know, being a father is hard to explain, because I felt it. I could not even say it in words what it was. But I felt there was a certain energy, and the priority shifts right away. You know, it shifts when you hear that she's pregnant, but when she was actually there.
I think it's different when the kid pops out, right?
Oh, different, man. Different.
I believe it.
So, that was the main priority at that point, you know? Mm-hmm. And I had to focus on, okay, how can I create time for my family and focus on what I have to do? So I had to make decisions. Yeah. Modeling was easy to give up. That was always a bit of a side thing for me, you know?
But it's pretty hard to turn down a nice day rate, right? For a day of work.
I didn't care.
You didn't care? You're just like, I'm out.
The most important day rate was my kid.
Well, being able to go to work for one day and get that money versus like having to go to work for a week or on the road.
Of course, but I was doing three things.
Yeah, I get it.
You know, so, basketball was my whole life. Basketball was my identity. Basketball made me who I am today.
Yeah.
Made me who I am mentally as I am today.
Yeah.
You know, and I never thought that even within music, it would give me, basketball would give me so much for my music career, because I'm telling you, if I didn't play basketball and I would grow into music as I'm growing right now, and having people that love you but also having people that hate you saying stuff on the internet, blah, 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 I would not survive so easily. I'm telling you.
Oh, I believe it.
But it's easy for me now, and of course you run into obstacles, but it's easy for me to get back to my grounded theory.
Yeah, there you go.
Get back to my grounded theory and to come back to me and stick to what I believe in, keep doing what I do, stay focused because of basketball. 100%.
Yeah, I mean, I can see it. It's very inherent in you. Like, that's why I brought up in the beginning of the podcast. Like, it's definitely going to form you and determine how you process things later. Like,
right.
Start, you know, I'm hesitant to call DJing a business or a career or any of that stuff, those, you know, because it's not. But at the same time, like, it is something that requires more than you just pushing play on Ableton and begging people on email to put out records. Like, it takes a lot to really put yourself out there and show up and do your best, blah, blah, blah. Yeah. And obviously you learned all that hard work and dedication from somewhere else, right?
Yeah, but not even that part. I think the most important thing where I try to bring the mentality that I have from basketball is, with basketball, if you play against the number one, mm-hmm. you got to bring your best effort. But when you play against the number 12, who might have been the last team, you got to bring your best effort, because if you don't bring your best effort, that game might be iffy.
That's true.
You might lose it, you know? So that game might turn around, because basketball can turn around quickly, and you might lose with 20 points. And I can tell you, the game before Christmas break, we would always lose that, because everybody's already there. Everybody's with Christmas already. So for me, to bring that mentality to music was, I could play for Awakenings and bring my best effort, but I could also go to a small club somewhere else and still bring that same mentality to bring my best effort. Mm-hmm. Because the mentality that I have for it is that the people that are coming and they come for me, they're just as much worth as the 10,000 people that might watch me.
For sure.
You know, and if I'm going to be slack and just be like, oh, this is an easy gig, let me get my money, get out of here, I'm cheating on myself.
Yeah.
I'm not showing the love that I actually, and the passion that I've had for it. And then it becomes business.
Yeah, then you get tired of it.
Yeah. You know, so I tried. And of course you have bad experience, good experience, less experience, more experiences. But, you know, I try to learn from the bad, from the worst experience, and try to bring it to my better ones, you know, and enjoy, try to enjoy every show. When it's 50 people, enjoy it. When it's 100 people, enjoy it. When it's 1,000 or 10,000, try to enjoy it.
Absolutely. I mean, I've had that same situation. You show up and there's 30 people at the club, if you're lucky, and you're like, well, you still got to bring it, because those people came out to see you, you know? Right. And who knows? Like, if you come back in the future, those 30 people might have been like, dude, he sucked last time. Why would I invest in this again?
Exactly.
Those 30 people might bring more, just like it happened at your party, right?
You know? Exactly.
So, man, I mean, between basketball, you know, getting up for the gym and leaving the club in the morning and having a baby, I guess you've seen your share of mornings, huh?
Yeah. I know, but I'm also a morning person.
Yeah.
As much as I'm a night person. So that's weird.
You're still figuring out your clock or whatever.
No, I'm happy. I don't have to do that, because I can go to bed easily at 10 or 11 and wake up at 7 and be fresh.
That's pretty.
But I can also go to bed at 2 and wake up at 7. And still kind of, you know, feel good enough to get through the day.
Yeah.
So I'm so glad that I can actually function on not too much sleep. And also the rhythm of the weekend doesn't reflect too much on the rhythm during the week. Because I work out a lot still. And I do notice when I don't work out, it does affect me a lot.
I was going to ask, yeah.
Yeah, it does affect me a lot. So I need to play. And I need, like, for example, I need to play tennis when I'm doing a lot now. And I need to go to the gym to be able to be fit for the weekend and actually feel good during the week.
Yeah, I mean, nobody's going to believe me, but when I was younger, I actually did go to the gym and put in effort. And I was more
quite
athletic.
In shape, man.
I don't even necessarily eat healthy, but I don't eat. Well, I eat junk food too. I don't know. Whatever. But the point is, I have to get into it. And I notice on the weekends now they hurt a little bit more.
Yeah.
Especially as I get older and I haven't been working out, you know. So
yeah.
I'm going to get into it. It's got to like, I just turned 40, man. So like,
you don't look 40, champ.
That's right. Thank you. But it gets a lot harder as you get older. So I'm like, okay, I need to change some habits. You know what I mean?
It's funny that you say that, because I also noticed that with basketball. You know, when I was 18, I could get on the court without a warm-up and, you know, make the craziest and quickest moves.
Mm-hmm.
But when I was getting close to 30, I had to do pre-warm-up.
Oh, yeah.
I need to do stretching. I need to do a warm-up and then get on the court and slowly get into it. Because otherwise you would get hurt.
Yeah.
So, and now, because of that in my basketball career, I now realize things where when I don't work out and my lower back started hurting, whatever, I know I need to work out. I need to work on my glutes. I need to work on the lower back, because otherwise, if I do this week to week to week and all the flights that we're taking, all the airports that you've been chilling at, it's going to hurt
back
you.
Back up, dude. Big
yes,
time.
Yes.
I mean, you know, I don't travel as much as I used to, which is both good and bad, but I'll tell you what, I do not miss these airplane seats minimum of 3 days a week. You know, like, I don't know. It really, the pandemic changed something to me, because like I really was hitting the road hard since I was 18 years old, and then really for the first time ever hitting the pause button. And that's when I realized, like, wow, man, I've had so many Ryanair flights or whatever. You're at that 90-degree angle, and you're like, my back, I'm surprised that it actually holds up as well as it still does, which I'm a big believer in, like, having the right shoes, because I used to have shitty shoes, and my back, that's when I really felt it, you know?
The importance of shoes, for sure.
Yeah. Well, I know we're getting close. I want to end with a few fun questions here. There's a lot I'd still love to go over, but I think it's been cool. Right? Yeah, we're good. We got a little bit.
Yeah.
Just some random ones. Like, are you optimistic about the future?
When it comes to music or life?
Life.
You know, when I create my own bubble and my own family, I'm very optimistic because I have a daughter that's 3 years old, and I want to bring her the best future ever, you know? But when I look at the world, and, you know, we can talk deep about politics and stuff, but when I look at the world and how, you know, racism is all of a sudden becoming bigger, far right in countries are, you know, getting hand in government again, you know, Israel, Gaza, actually Palestina, Israel, Palestina, Russia, and
Ukraine,
and Ukraine, South Sudan, Congo, all the stuff that we're seeing right now is painful, man. It's so painful, and it feels hard to see that you're not powerful enough to do something. You know, that's why I'm actually vocal, and that's why I'm actually speaking up, is, you know, at least what I'm thinking and, you know, my thoughts about things, and show where I stand as a human being. But also, most importantly, really appreciating what I have. We're living in a society, we're living in a time where people are so focused on what they want to get. You know, everybody wants to become rich. Everybody is focused on social media and how they can, you know, how they can work remotely everywhere 9 months a year. Or, you know, nobody wants to do the dirty job anymore. And I think it's very important, and especially in times like this where you cannot do too much yourself to change it, you better start appreciating what you do have.
Absolutely.
Know? And appreciate the light that we have in our room, and the Wi-Fi is working, and the food that we have, and, you know, the little things we can nag about.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's important for us to look back at ourselves and be like, hey, I'm actually healthy. You know, I can actually wake up in peace. I can hear the birds outside or the tram ride. You know, these little things that you never think about because you consider it so normal.
Absolutely. You
know? So for me, that's how I humble myself. You know, to be happy what I have, to be able to pay for my rent, to be able to have my car, you know, to get my daughter whatever she need. This for me is richness.
You know? Absolutely. That's a great way to put it. You know, like, I think it's an important thing to remember. Like, I know there was a point maybe around 2016-ish, 17, where, like, honestly, things were going really well and, like, money was just kind of rolling in, and you get tired of being on the road and the usual complaints that come from really doing it a lot. But then you kind of lose the concept of, like, well, some people are working for 10 euros an hour or something, and, like, you forget, like, how easy things come, and then you don't really take it for granted. So now on the second run after the pandemic, when things do come through, I'm, like, way more appreciative of the things that are coming my way. And I know it's because I worked hard to, like, put out records and really stay on top of this to have people interested in booking me around the world. But now I appreciate it way more, I have to say.
Right. That's good.
Yeah. I mean, I ask this question to a lot of people, but it's like, you know, basketball player, Olympian, model, world traveling DJ, like, you've already accomplished a lot of things, but do you have any other big aspirations?
Not really.
No,
I just, you know, Kobe Bryant was my favorite athlete and one of my biggest idols. Muhammad Ali is my biggest idol, alongside my dad. They were both boxers.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. but, you know, what Kobe always said is, the result is beautiful, but the journey, that's the most important thing you need to focus on, and what you need to enjoy the most.
1,000%.
So when people tell me, what is your dream, or what do you want to accomplish? I think it's a super valid question, but I'm trying to live the dream and try to enjoy this journey as much as I can, being a father, you know, being being the DJ, being a promoter of a party, and enjoy this moment. Because, you know, I don't know how it's going to be in 2-3 years. You know, absolutely. You don't know. So if I'm going to focus too much on 10 years, you know, I forget to enjoy 100% of what is happening now.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm really focusing on living in the moment, but also do hold myself accountable of, how do you say this? Holding myself accountable of being the best version of myself every day.
Yeah.
And becoming better every day in what I do. So what I mean by saying this is that, you know, things are going really well for me right now. And it's easy for me to actually enjoy it so much that I'm kind of like chilling. Like, oh, I can chill a bit. Everything I'm doing anyways.
You should.
Yeah, of course. But if you lose that sense of organic eager where you want to work hard for it, then you also, like for instance,
you got to be a little hungry.
Yeah, but also still keep appreciating the little things. So for instance, I'm having more and closer contact with some of my idols. But if I'm going to see them as like, oh yeah, they're buddies now.
No.
Then it, that special feeling of you know, having your idols in your circle is losing it, you know, because you think they're just your buddies now. No, I still hold them to that same value and still appreciate that so much. And then it stays special for me. You know, playing at some of the most favorite clubs that I want to play at, I will keep it and keep that same eagerness, the same love for it and passion for it, because then it stays special.
Absolutely.
You know, so that's what I mean by, you know, really living in that moment.
Yeah. You know, when you brought it up earlier, like, I think it's okay to not get too comfortable, but to also enjoy a little bit of the success as well, you know?
Yeah.
Like, there was a, if you want another quote, it's like, success without fulfillment is the ultimate ultimate failure.
Yeah.
Which is true. Like, you got to really appreciate when it comes. But yeah, there's times where you go into cruise control and that gets a little dangerous. So,
yeah. I mean, I do, like, at the same time as I'm working hard, I do really enjoy every part of it, you know? Even the traveling, which you don't hear a lot.
Yeah, I mean, well, you know, there are times when it's really fun. Like, it's nice to really, unfortunately, I don't really hang out in the cities for an extra day or two like I used to. I'm trying to change that. But I used to do that, and it's so fun to, like, just figure out what the hell's going on with the locals and seeing the world.
Yeah.
I know it's a little harder now that you have a kid and everything. You got to get home and be a dad and stuff.
But. Yeah, like on the cities that I've already seen, I try to go home as fast as possible to my family.
No,
but you know, South Africa, I always take a couple days, and when I do a longer tour, a week or longer, I do take days also to explore, because I think it's important. And I'm lucky that my girlfriend really lets me also, you know.
Totally. Any funny worst tour experiences worth mentioning, or not really?
Shit, I don't even know which flight that was again, but I think it was from Ireland to Portugal or something. And I was in a Ryanair flight.
Mm-hmm.
And we got delayed for 6 hours. And I was in the plane.
Oh, I've had that before.
With a class of 14-year-old kids in front of me. And they were going crazy. Plus, my phone died.
Oh,
plus,
no.
My headphones died. So I had no music, no phone. And I was in there for 6 hours.
Just raw dogging it. Oh, man.
Bro.
Brutal.
I didn't even have to think about this one.
Yeah.
This was the worst one.
I bet. I had that one time. The first time I ever played Output in New York, I played with Adam Baer, and we get together. There's a lot of tequila around. And I flew back the next day, and we got delayed on the tarmac for 5 hours. They shut it off the plane and the AC, and it was like 30 degrees Celsius, 90 Fahrenheit. I was so fucking hungover, man. I thought I was going to die. I'm like, okay. That was actually one of the last times where I was like, all right, I'm not going to party so hard on the road anymore. I learned my lesson from that. So
that's funny.
I always ask, any worst job stories, or always worst just basketball? Stories.
Oh yeah, no,
like,
I've always played basketball.
Mall or anything like that.
Actually, I was. That's funny. Actually, I forgot about that. When I was 17, you know, I came back from my exchange here in Amsterdam, and I wanted to do something because my friends were still in school. And I had to wait for the next basketball season. So it was like 4 months that I had to overlap. And I was always into fashion. I love fashion, you know. And I worked in a clothing store. It's called Men at Work in Amsterdam. And my dad even told me, like, you don't have to work. Just focus on basketball. This is what you do. And there's not a lot of dads that would say that.
Totally.
You know what I mean? So
that's pretty awesome.
You know, he was a sportsman himself. So he knew the importance of focusing on one thing and just, you know, put all that effort in. But I wanted to make some money on myself. And I worked there 4 days a week and got my first paycheck. And I saw it was 164 euros. And I said, yo, I'm out, homie.
That was, mine was 160 my first paycheck. So, yo, yeah.
Yo, I was like, man, I did four days a week for all that little money?
Yeah. Dude, and like at that time I was in high school and I had my first girlfriend and I forgot what I bought her something, you know, and there went half my $160 check. I'm like, I don't know if this is the life for me. They're like, get used to it, man. That's the real world.
Yeah, it makes you appreciate the other things for sure.
Sure.
But I did feel like a bit of a spoiled brat, you know, giving up after 1 month. But yeah.
Hey,
I
mean, you my dad won. Shot.
Yeah, I gave it a shot, and my dad warned me, and I you know, I was focused on basketball anyways. Yeah. You know, so I just wanted to do something in the time that I was back home.
Right on. Well, it's been fun. I'll get you out of here. Is there anything that you want to plug? We'll get this out, you know, by mid-October. Anything worth mentioning?
That's it.
All right.
It was cool. It was very fun.
Yeah, it's been a lot of fun. Yeah, have a good one, man.
Thank you, man. Thank you for having me, Justin.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Yes, sir.